ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley from ABC News Daily, the podcast that brings you one big story affecting your world each weekday in just 15 minutes.
Coles has been disguising these price rises as price discounts when in fact they're not, is what the ACCC alleges.
Join me for ABC News Daily. Find us on ABC Listen.
Today, the Australian people have voted for Australian values.
The choice is simple for the Liberal Party. Change or die.
Politics is the brutal game of arithmetic, but no one's going to vote for you if you don't stand for something.
We've always been about the planet, but we've got to make sure that people have their daily needs met.
People are starting to see that there is actually a different way of doing politics.
Hello and welcome to The Party Room. I'm Patricia Carvalis and I'm joining you from Wurundjeri country in Melbourne.
And I'm Fran Kelly on the Gadigal land of the Eora Nation in Sydney. And PK, we are back again to answer some questions from our listeners. I'm always blown away by how many amazing questions we get.
Yeah, we do actually, and they've some meaty good ones today. But before we get to your questions, Fran, it's official. Former opposition leader Susan Lee has tendered her immediate resignation from Parliament. So immediate, in fact, that she won't be going back to Parliament when it starts again next week to do it there. She won't even return to that sort of theatre to provide a speech. She officially now sparks a by-election in her seat of Farrow, which we, of course, knew was coming, but it's now official, the date to be established. She has said lots of things in her exit comments, but some very what is known colloquially as a drive-by to the new opposition leader. She says, "I believe my election as the first woman to ever lead, not just the federal Liberal Party, but any federal opposition, is a milestone for all women to be proud of. I hope I have paved the way for the next woman to be elected to and succeed in both these roles." Okay, well, that's not a full drive-by. I mean, that's a fact, right? But there was a bit of a comment about all of the policies and directions that have been adopted by the Liberal Party, which are exactly the same as hers.
Well, yeah, that's true. And obviously you're not going to go from one leader and policy direction one day to something completely different the next. So we've talked about before, Angus Taylor really did ramp up, source up, if you like, the sort of the anti-immigration sentiment for sure. That's one thing.
No, and but that's her point, that she was about to.
And, I know. And there's been not much harking back to that. I agree. But, you know, we have commented on the change of tone, I think. But what I'm interested in that, I thought like her announcement that she was going to quit, I thought it was a very gracious statement she put out this time. But, you know, when she talked there about, "I hope I paved the way for the next woman to be elected to," is that a slap at, is that a drive-by too? Because the Libs got so few women elected or re-elected last time. I mean, they have such a massive problem with not only female voters, but female representation. They do just do not look like a modern party that reflects the community and certainly reflects women or women's interest. And I think she might have just been tapping into that a bit. But I think it's, you know, it's a big thing for everyone listening. Parliamentarians usually give a valedictory speech in the chamber before they go. And it's usually a big moment and lots of, you know, their political opponents and all their colleagues come in to hear it. And the fact that she's not doing that, she's saying, "I'm confident my efforts and achievements over 25 years will speak for themselves." I think it suggests that, you know, this is, she's probably taking this hard. Doesn't feel like being back amongst the colleagues that have just knifed her.
Yeah, I don't think she has any interest in being in that theatre. I've spoken to a few people actually who, you know, have observed Susan Lee over her 2.5 decades in the parliament who say she was never, you know, some people, and the Prime Minister's one of these people, the institution of the parliament is a big deal, a big space for them. But Susan Lee, that was never kind of her way or legacy. So there was a view that I think most people predicted she wouldn't want to do it in the parliament, or that wasn't her theatre, if you like. So no one's really surprised, actually. Look, Angus Taylor's response, you know, sort of is, you know, playing it safe, you know, paying tribute to her this morning, her work ethic, it's been so relentless, like all of the kind motherhood statements about it. But at the end of the day, he now has to fight an election in her seat under great scrutiny, as he should be, to see whether he can deliver that seat. Different views, as we discussed in the party room yesterday, if you haven't listened to our regular episode with Jacob about, you know, whether it's winnable or not for the coalition. John Black told me, which we mentioned, that, you know, he thinks it's been over-egged, that they're going to lose it. And in fact, some ways it gives this is his view, and I just want to put that out there because I didn't really talk enough about it yesterday, I reckon. Just this point. He reckons that it actually makes Angus Taylor's life easy, I'll explain, because if there's all these expectations that Farah's about to be lost by the coalition, right, that's a narrative that's building, and he wins it, that's very good for him, isn't it, right?
Oh, yeah, that's right. He's a giant killer. I mean, that's right. Everyone wants to be the underdog. That's, you know, a well-worn path, isn't it? But let's see. I mean, I think that Susan Lee has surprised a little in how early she's done this. I mean, he's got to get his skates on now, Angus Taylor. They haven't pre-selected a candidate yet, neither of the Nats. Neither has One Nation, I don't think. So, you know, the clock's ticking now.
Things are ticking. Should we get to our questions?
Let's do it.
Questions without notice. Are there any questions? Prime Minister has the call.
Thanks very much, Mr. Speaker. Well,
can I give the call to the Honourable, the Leader of the Opposition?
The bells are ringing. That means it's time for question time. This week, our first question comes from Finn.
G'day, Fran and PK. My name's Finn. I'm a student studying at ANU in Canberra. I've heard a lot of discussion about how if the Albanese government were to make any changes surrounding negative gearing and capital gains taxes, this would be politically risky, hence why we haven't seen any changes made thus far. However, it made me wonder, are the majority of people who support the current regulations surrounding negative gearing and capital gains taxes even voting for Labor? And as such, would changing these laws actually affect Labor's vote and be a huge political risk? Or do you think it would actually be received positively by much of Labor's established voter base? Thanks a lot.
Well, Finn, that's certainly a very question right in the zeitgeist, and I think the government's trying to work out that ratio right now, where they're going to cut or wind back capital gains tax and negative gearing. I think they're trying to calculate the politics because the politics have been very difficult for Labor in the past, just ask Bill Shorten. But the times are different, and the latest polling I've seen on this says that about 40% of Australians would back cutting the capital gains tax discount, or certainly cutting it back to, say, 25%. So I think there's so many signals from the government that I think there are clear signs that they're going to do something on the capital gains tax and wind it back a bit. But the danger for them is that the political attack from the Liberal Party is that, you know, Labor then becomes again the high-spending, high-taxing party. They are a party of bigger taxes because they're going to be depriving some people who currently have this tax cut of this tax cut. And there's a lot of them. 1.2 million Australians, negative gear properties, something like that. Sure, a lot of them are higher income earners. I think 20% of them are doctors, which is a fun fact. But a lot of middle income earners too. So the government has to get the settings right. I think they're almost certainly likely to grandfather those who already own properties, so they wouldn't be affected by it. It'll be future properties, and plenty of economists giving them plenty of advice on this, including just leave capital gains tax where it is for investments in new properties, for instance, new builds, so that it encourages more building to take place. But I think this is all the calculations that are going on in the Treasurer's office at the moment. What do you reckon, PK?
Yeah, they're all absolutely going on. But remember, the Treasurer made sure that we all knew, because I know, because he confirmed it back to me in an interview, but that, you know, he'd briefed his Treasury that this has to be economics, not politics, this budget. You know, that's a way of saying go and do this stuff, you know, come up with these ideas because they are willing to take on the political risks. Now, the bigger question here, though, at the heart, I don't think, Finn, we've kind of properly dealt with all due respect to my lovely Fran, but with some of the, like, the question you saying about the voters that don't vote for them, like the idea of, you know, who people vote for. I think, and Finn, I think your question is smart, but also I don't think politics in Australia, because elections are won in the centre and there is still a lot of swinging votes and there are fewer safe seats, I don't think it's quite that calculation of who votes for you and who doesn't anymore. And so I think we need to dispense with that a little bit, that idea of who are your people and who are not your people. The other part of this is in terms of voters and voter sentiment, sometimes even if you're not affected by something directly, a smart, politically savvy scare campaign works on the premise that you might want a bit of that in the future, right? So you might not negatively gear, but hey, you wouldn't mind being part of that. You like the sort of idea. So that's kind of sometimes you can really appeal to people on a sort of deeper level, aspirational voters, you know? So there's that as well. And then I think they've been waiting, and I think they did this with stage three tax cuts. You know, they love to tell us how they made that bold decision to dump the promise they'd made not to touch the way that those tax cuts worked. But the truth is, yes, they were at the end of the day, they did make that decision, and hats off to them because I think the public liked it. But equally, it was only made after the public case was really established. So I think, Finn, what they're really waiting for is for a voter consensus to be very strong, that property taxes need to be tackled. That's what they're waiting for. And I think they're nearly there, actually. But a lot of it is the heavy lifting going on outside of the parliament. Don't you reckon, Fran?
Well, that's right. And we mentioned this yesterday on the podcast. There's that Senate Select Committee going on into the capital gains tax at the moment. And, you know, not everyone, but overwhelming majority of those making submissions and coming before them, including former Reserve Bank governors and former ACTU secretaries and plenty of economists, are making the case that the capital gains tax is unfair. It's warping the housing market to some degree, not a huge degree, but to the degree that it's got investors in the market when what we are trying to get is the people who need houses in the market. And it's one more thing I just want to add here finally is that, and I mentioned this yesterday too, it's the vibe of this. The debate at the moment is about intergenerational inequity. And partly that is fueled by the fact that it is true. And you know, if we're the country of the fair go, let's make it fair for younger Australians too. But partly it's the arithmetic, because the biggest voting block now is the combination of millennial and Gen Z voters, younger voters, and these are the ones who are being basically priced out of the housing market. There was incredible figures out this week to show that, you know, first homeowners on normal wages at the moment, there's not one capital city that their first home is affordable on that sort of wage. I mean, that is a shocking statistic. It's way out of whack. We have a housing crisis on many fronts, and inequity is just one of them. And so this would be a big signal that this government cares about intergenerational inequity or equity, and it's doing something about it. That's almost what I think the political headline, if you know, signal is from this.
Yeah, I think that's what they're going for and what they're trying to build towards. Look, our next question comes from Louise from Tasmania, and she's written the question. Thanks, Louise, for sending it. Dear Fran and PK, after Pauline Hanson saying there are no good Muslims, I was wondering how that stacks up against what you know about the new hate speech laws. Love the pod. Thank you so much, Louise. Okay. Yes, the anti-vilification hate speech element of the bill ended up being dumped. Do you remember? So there was the first version that perhaps would have very much gone to some of this. And then perhaps, as I say, you still have to meet thresholds. So I'm not going to give you a legal interpretation, but it certainly dealt with this idea of speech. Then the government had to back down, remember, from that omnibus big bill and really water it down. The opposition refused to support it. There was an outcry on free speech grounds. Even the Greens opposed even the new bill on the basis of the free speech element. So, you know, from the left and the right. So just to be very accurate about who was opposing this. So that's, I think, how it interacts, doesn't it, Fran?
No, you're right. I mean, that we haven't got that omnibus bill, and that's what people in the community and those who suffer discrimination all the time were calling for. But the government didn't go there. The politics just wasn't working for them. They couldn't get the votes. But we do have laws, and Pauline Hanson has been found guilty in 2024 of being a breach of the Racial Discrimination Act, I think it was, against the Green Senator Maureen Faruqi after she posted some offensive comments online there. And in this case, what we've seen after the no good Muslims comments from Pauline Hanson, we have seen the mayor of Canterbury-Bankstown, Bilal El-Hayek, calling for Pauline Hanson to be charged under current hate laws. And we've also had the New South Wales police say they've received reports of a crime. So there's talk around this, whether she's in breach of any current laws, but the laws that I think you're talking about are those ones that Patricia was talking about, and they haven't come into law. The government says it's not interested in bringing them back anytime soon either. So I think that'll be one of those things that's going to follow public pressure again, and we ain't there yet.
No. No, we are so not there. We are very far from there. All right. Next question comes from Susanna.
Hi, Fran. Hi, PK. The Prime Minister's had several recent missteps, calling Grace Tame difficult, abandoning the ISIS-linked children, inviting President Isaac Herzog, and the delayed response to the Bondi attack. Does this point to a broader generational misread of the national mood, or is there a gap between his political instincts and where modern Australia actually sits?
Oh, Susanna, this is a really interesting question. So, and also, there's a few different things here, right? So you talk about Grace Tame and the comment that she was difficult, which we talked about in the pod on Thursday. He then, after actually we recorded Fran, remember, he kind of provided what was really a caveat explaining that he didn't mean it that way. He was referring to having a difficult life. Then Grace Tame.
I think it's called trying to mop it up, right?
Definitely. Well, he claims that's really what he meant. So, okay, let's take it on face value, although there's a lot of cynicism about whether that was the case.
Grace Tame didn't take it on face value.
No, she didn't. She called him old man, patronising old man, a patronising old man. Condescending was the word. Actually, I think it was condescending. And also said he's just basically like Scott Morrison. It was condescending.
Save me the condescension, old man, was the social media post, I believe.
I like it. Grace, tell me what you really think. Okay, so that's what Grace Tame says. Okay, it's a bit of a, you know, I think it was definitely bad for him. So there was that. Then the abandonment of the ISIS-linked children, okay? And then you say inviting President Isaac Herzog. Now, I think they're all a bit different. I don't think they're all the same, but your point is, and your question is, does it point to a broader generational misread of the national mood? Ooh, this one's tricky, and I don't like to disagree with our lovely listeners, but I don't think it's one. I don't think it's just generational that everyone agrees on these things in one generation. I think those three issues are different. Well, two of them are linked. I also think that in terms of misreading the national mood, I think one thing he is misreading is the view of the left. Now, the left is part of his base. He's made a decision to take on his own base. That's not always bad for a leader, by the way. So, yes, he's misreading or deliberately disagreeing with the mood of the left, which is his base. But I don't know if it's the national mood. In fact, if you look at the polling on ISIS-linked women and their children, whether we like it or not, the majority of Australians don't want them to come back. Now, I'm not saying that's right or wrong, but that is not the national mood. I just want to be clear. Sometimes the mood is different to what's in the progressive part of Australia. That's all I'm really saying.
I think that's right. And although the Prime Minister is from the left and, you know, was a left firebrand in his youth, he is in a different position now. He's weathered a lot of political storms and he's very proud of his political instincts soon. I think that's why we saw him lose his mojo after The Voice was so roundly defeated, because he really believed in his gut that he was speaking for Australia at that point, and that really kind of destabilised him. But on this, I think on ISIS, you're absolutely right. He knows where the public mood is. He's lived through Labor governments being completely brought down almost by immigration issues, and he's not going to go there. And inviting President Isaac Herzog, well, you know, I think there's a lot of people who thought that was the wrong call. He made it at a time of, well, high tension, high stress and high concern and sympathy in this country for the Jewish community after so many Jewish Australians were murdered in the Bondi massacre. It was a difficult time. But, you know, we've seen how it played out on the streets, and that certainly hasn't helped social cohesion. So for a Prime Minister who said social cohesion is one of his major challenges and major concerns, that didn't help. You know, has he misstepped? I think PK's right. He's left his base here, but we've seen others on the left, including Labor MP Julian Hill, this week, who's close to the Prime Minister and he's very much embedded in the left. He made a speech where he indicated that the left needs to, how would you describe it, PK, back off a bit?
Yeah, turn the temperature down a bit. Support Australia Day, support the flag, like progressive
that
patriotism.
That was an interesting intervention. I thought progressive patriotism, that's exactly right. That's the phrase coined by the Prime Minister of where he's at. And I think that's how this all fits in.
Yeah, it's an interesting perspective, and they're trying to sort of fight the culture war within the left in some ways, and that's a whole other podcast. Like, it's actually a really interesting thing that they're trying to do. In some ways, I can see the merits, particularly on things like the flag. I mean, Julian Hill's argument was don't let the sort of extreme right hijack our national flag. And I think he makes a good point there, actually, because the flag, because it's been adopted by some extremely unsavory figures of the extreme nationalist, even neo-Nazi right, they've used it, and that is very problematic, right, because that is our national flag. Like, we should not ever be surrendering our national flag to fascists, right? So I get the point he's trying to make, but the amount of convincing he's going to have to do to progressives who feel uncomfortable with some of these symbols is going to be pretty hard, right? Look, there are plenty more questions. So we like you so much, we're going to do another bonus. You know, pretty much I can reveal here that it'll be semi-regular. You'll hear more. We'll be giving you more of these episodes. So do not fear, your questions will be answered. That's it for the Party Room this week. David Spears will be back for Insiders on Background on Saturday, speaking with Bernie Fraser, former RBA governor, and he will be talking about the capital gains tax discount, all the property tax stuff. Then I'll be back for Politics Now on Monday.
Of course, you never stop talking politics. And remember to follow Politics Now on ABC Listen, because not only do you hear PK Monday to Friday, but that's where you hear this Party Room podcast too. So you never miss an episode.
See you, Fran.
See you, PK.